How important was the minister's role in colonial America? Here's a hint. It was a lot more active and a lot more important than we find often with the ministry today in modern America. Hello and welcome to this portion of Vocal Point. I'm Jerry Newcomb, and our guest is Dr. Peter Lilback. He and I had the privilege to write a book together many years ago called George Washington's Sacred Fire, which became a bestseller. And last time I was at Mount Vernon, I saw it there for sale. Dr. Lilback is the founder and president of Providence Forum. He's also a Presbyterian minister ordained in the PCA. And not speaking for the seminary, he is the president of Westminster Theological Seminary. Dr. Lilback, it's great to have you back on the program. Thank you for joining us.
Jerry, what a treat to be back with you and to also share with all of your listeners. It's a great honor.
Were the ministers in colonial America a lot more active in everyday life, in effect, than, say, the ministers of today?
Well, to try to answer that question, we need to see the vast difference that exists with the pastor and the clergyman in our era compared to what the world was like back at that beginning of our country. The first thing that I think is significant is to remember we're living in the context of what has been called the Johnson Amendment. That's named for Senator Lyndon Baines Johnson from the great state of Texas. It was a law that he added to the tax code under his legislative leadership that said if any church enters into politics and using the pulpit to that end, they will run afoul of the IRS standards of nonprofit organizations, that they'll lose their tax-exempt status. Now, that certainly got people's attention because, one, it meant if you addressed issues like, should we vote for Senator Johnson again? Yeah, he said, wow, you are going to lose your tax exemption. Two, it also had the potential of running afoul with the government, and the church generally wants to be a good citizen, a good partner with the community. Also, that is intensified over years because there is within every pastor's heart, it's a good thing and it can be a temptation to do wrong, and that is to have everybody like him. Obviously, you want to be liked when you're preaching, you want to be liked as a pastor, but sometimes that means that you don't want to touch difficult things that might have controversy associated with it or differences of opinions, and so sometimes a pastor can be quiet about things that he know might be controversial. Well, whether that's good or bad in your mind or as a listener, back in the day when America was beginning to be formed, the clergyman played quite a different role. Because first of all, there were established churches. And so you could imagine if you were a clergyman in the Anglican tradition, you would tend to want to favor the king and the parliament and stand with their positions because there was a seamless connection between the church and the government. Now, if you were not a member of the Anglican Church and you wanted to critique what was going on and not be in support fully of the King's Church, such as the Puritans in New England from the Congregational tradition, they would be much more willing to critique the Anglican Church, the King, and its position as they developed their own platform for government and theology and doctrine in the New England states. So you can see that inherently by the very nature of the church being associated or having to break from the government, it would make the pulpit more direct about issues that might impact the government and might be controversial. The second thing that is really true in that era is that they were living much closer to the Reformation. And we forget just how radical the Reformation was in all of its forms. There was a break between the Roman Catholic Church that had a Catholic monarch and a Catholic government, a Catholic culture, and a direct link with the Pope and Roman Catholic theology. To be a Protestant following whether Luther or Zwingli, Calvin or Cranmer, you are in fact breaking not just with the church, but also with the government. And it required you to have the courage to even translate the Bible, encourage people to read it, both of which could be capital crimes. So there was an inherent courage in the Protestant movement that said, we will risk our lives to translate the Bible. We will risk our lives to preach the Bible. We will risk our lives to learn to read the Bible on our own. And many of the Protestants were, in fact, persecuted deeply. So there was an inherent courage. There's another reason, I think, why even in the American context, where that persecution had substantially lessened because of the vast distance of the ocean and carving out a new civilization in a wilderness. And that is the fact that the church was a central part of the social structure of the communities that basically were being built. The church was a place where people who may not even had a deep faith would eventually want to come because it often provided education, it often provided community social services, and also it served as a place of information. Remember, there's no telephone. It's hard to believe, no smartphones, no television, no radio, no fax machines, no newspapers almost in most places. It was an oral culture, and that you went to church, and often as part of the sermon or in the prayer meeting, you would hear about news that had happened in other places as it was brought to town. So the church was inherently a place of relevancy, information, cultural communication. And so we might expect then, if with all of that backdrop, that the early pastorate played a pivotal role, a vital role, in establishing the legitimacy of the American Revolution, the principles of standing against what they thought was unjust decisions by Parliament. And so we can understand why ministers began to be called the Black-Robed Regiment. We can understand why a minister named John Witherspoon actually signed the Declaration of Independence. So we can go a number of directions from that point, but those contextual clues then help us to see that the minister had to have a backbone to do his job in that day in a way that maybe isn't quite so evident in ministers today.
So the ministry really was active in politics, you know, in a very strong sense. In fact, one statistic that I remember reading, and this is absolutely astounding, but here we go, and it piggybacks exactly with what you were saying. At the time of American independence, according to Ben Hart, 98.4% of the Americans were professing Protestant Christians, 1.4% were Roman Catholic. That meant that 99.8% were professing Christians, but that's a huge percentage of Protestants. And the second point I want to make is that Dr. Donald Lutz from the University of Houston said that, in effect, the mass media at the time of American independence were the printed sermons of ministers that were literally circulating up and down, you know, the Atlantic seaboard, you know, and all the different colonies.
Yeah, that last point is one that, Jerry, you and I had a chance to celebrate in the life of George Washington himself. It's one of the great surprises of going through Washington's library. A large part of it was preserved at the Boston Athenaeum, was his collection of sermons. He had multiple volumes that he bound together, and you looked at the sermons, they were different paper publishing, different sizes, but they're bound into common volumes, and they were sermons that often were funeral sermons or celebratory sermons. And you could see that that sermon was chosen to be published because it carried a message that they wanted to circulate throughout an area, maybe through many colonies. And so it really is clear that in Washington's life, he was a sermon reader. There's records that say that on Sunday afternoons, George Washington and his wife Martha used to read sermons together as part of their Keeping the Lord's Day. It's quite remarkable. And so you can imagine they're sitting down and George would read the sermon to his wife and they would be learning theology, but they'd also be learning about a great hero that had passed away or a new celebration that occurred on some principle of government or some celebration of a life. So the idea of that being a communication vehicle is absolutely true. But what's interesting, the published word reflected the preached word that had preceded it.
Yes.
So it was almost as if the minister was like the herald, the town crier, making an announcement to the community. Do you know what's happened? And that would be given, and then it would be published, either written afterwards or written beforehand, and then given over to a printer and circulated. So the evidence is very clear that that was the case.
And as you said earlier, there was no media, there was nothing. So these sermons really were effective. And in fact, going back to Lutz, he and Dr. Heinemann did this massive study where they studied all these different quotes from the founding fathers in their writings of political nature, and they found that the Bible was quoted four times more than any human author. But of human authors, the three most quoted were, in this order, Montesquieu, Sir William Blackstone, and John Locke, all three of whom were Christian in their writings. But here's what Dr. Lutz adds to that. He said most of the founding fathers, or, you know, during the founding era, people would learn about these men, that is, you know, again, Montesquieu, Blackstone, and Locke, from the sermons of these preachers. So, in other words, the pulpit was like this hugely influential phenomenon within colonial America, especially at the time of independence. I mean, this is lost history.
So what we need to distinguish now, we want to be accurate in the sense that not every pulpit or every preacher had command of that kind of material. So we know that there were circuit riders, there were backwoods lay preachers, but even without the higher education that might be implied in our recent comments here, they would have been biblically literate because they had learned to read with the Bible, and the people they were preaching to had learned to read with the Bible as their school book. So there was a general biblical literacy. But when you move into the more settled areas like around New England, we should never forget that the Puritan settlers, they were absolutely committed to a trained clergy.
Yes.
In fact, one of the things they worried about is that when their ministers who had migrated in the New World died, who would lead them? And so they said, after they got their homes set up, the next thing they did was start praying about how will we care for the church in the future. And so one of the things they did is they started a college. Harvard College is the one. We know it today as Harvard University. And its purpose was to train ministers that people might know eternal life through faith in Jesus Christ and therefore have a knowledge of the gospel according to the Bible. And they were, in fact, highly educated people that left a great deal to come and bring their wisdom to a new culture. It's no accident that the intellectual center of America is around Boston, and that's where those Puritans settled. And they brought along with them the Bible and the classic knowledge of government and other things. And that percolated then through their preaching and the academic pulpits. And then that would be brought out to other areas without the same amount of education available through the printed means that would be circulated. So the intellectual center of the early colonial era, without doubt, was impacted by the clergy. In fact, it's interesting. It was only until the early 1900s that the rule was changed, which was generally true of academic institutions, that at least half of the board of that higher education institution needed to be ordained clergy.
Oh, wow.
They saw themselves as educated people with a Christian worldview that was making sure there was trained clergy members coming through the school and that values in all the disciplines reflected a biblical viewpoint. That's something that obviously changed with the final desire to move to a more secular direction. But 1900, well, you go back, we're talking about 1600s right up to 1900 or so, the importance of clergy leadership in academic contexts.
Okay, we have less than a minute to go, but I've got to tell you a quick anecdote about Harvard. You had paraphrased a few moments ago the words that are written and chiseled in stone at Harvard University in Cambridge, Massachusetts, saying that, you know, when our present ministry is lying in the dust, you know, we dreaded to leave an illiterate ministry, you know, when that happens, knowing, so therefore we started the school. Well, 2002, I got nice photographs of that plaque without any kind of interference. Last year I was there, 2018, to get some shots, and lo and behold, they had, in the interim, they had planted a tree right in front of it, so you can't even really see the sign unless you look for it. It's terrible, but we have 15 seconds to wrap up.
Okay, the rules and precepts of Harvard, second one said this, let every student be plainly instructed and earnestly pressed to consider well. The main end of his life and studies is to know God and Jesus Christ, his eternal life. John 17:3, and therefore to lay Christ in the bottom as the only foundation of all sound knowledge and learning, and seeing the Lord only giveth wisdom, let everyone seriously set himself by prayer in secret to seek it of him. Proverbs 2:3 and 3.
Wow. Proverbs, that's amazing. Providenceforum.org for more information. Thank you, Dr. Loback.
Thank you.
Okay.